Hey guys, I'm Valerie.
And I'm Jasmine, and this is Crafts, Drafts, and Crime.
And this is our very last episode of Season 8. We have gotten here kind of quick, and we haven't yet announced what Season 9 is going to be. So, are you ready?
Okay, give it to me.
Okay, so we are going to be covering cases that how do I put this? Maybe this sounds stupid, actually, because I haven't really thought out a way to phrase it, because it's not like a, you know, like this is like, oh, local cases. This season is going to be about cases that were ruled as accidental that we think should be ruled as homicides. So we have discussed several cases that are like, actually, most of them kind of infuriating. And I know it might sound kind of like our mysterious death season, but this is going to be completely different because we're telling you up front. We think they should be labeled as homicides. We are not going to in any way point fingers at anybody, that being said. But it's going to be a series of what, you know, police consider to be accidents. So it's going to be a really interesting season. And, you know, we're excited to bring these cases, you know, to life for you guys. And hopefully, you know, there's some stuff that you've never heard of. Because a lot of these people, you know, they were ruled as accidents. These aren't open investigations anymore. So we're going to do it the best that we can to tell you guys everything that we know about these.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that. I know you told me about one, and that's going to be a doozy. I feel like everybody will agree with us after they hear that one specific one.
Yes.
But yeah.
And we're actually starting out with that one. So it's going to be the very first episode is going to be a doozy. It's going to be a long one, and I want you all to get excited to hear about it. So today, to end the last of our season 8, we are going to be talking about a case that I had actually never heard of until David's mom brought it up to me. So I want to do a quick shout out to Jackie. Thank you so much for bringing this to my attention. And this case is the Wilmington 10.
So I remember when you first brought it to me, like you told me about it, I did kind of look it up a little bit. But prior to that, I had never heard of this before. And I feel like did actually ask Facebook after you told me about it. I just wanted to get like a general consensus of like how many people had heard about this or learned about this in college or, you know, because we didn't. You know, they obviously didn't tell us about it in high school during history classes or anything, even though I feel like that's something important, like, for us living, or for, like, the high school that I went to being close to Wilmington. So I didn't understand why they bypassed it. But, yeah, I feel like there was maybe, like, 3 people that knew about it. So, yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for all of this.
Yes. So to sum it up, I'm going to tell you all the details, but to sum it up, the Wilmington 10 are 10 civil rights activists who were falsely convicted and jailed for almost 10 years after a riot in 1971 over school desegregation that were completely wrongly convicted of arson and conspiracy. And the sources for this are Britannica, justice.gov. They have the entire case transcript in there. I read an embarrassing amount of it, honestly. It is so extensive, but I wanted to go through and I wanted to kind of get the best picture of this and of these people who were involved as I possibly could so that I could share that with you guys. And then I also read a few articles from the New York Times and the Washington Post. So MLK Jr., when Martin Luther King Jr. died, you learned about that in school, right?
Yes.
So this is what's really interesting to me, because this is kind of tied into where the story begins. So Martin Luther King Jr. canceled his visit to speak at Williston Senior High School on April 4th of 1968. It was an all-black school. Instead, he stayed in Memphis, Tennessee, and that's the day that he was killed. Well, Williston High School is in Wilmington, North Carolina. So the next day, peaceful protests took place at high schools in Wilmington, led to violent riots. So the National Guard had to occupy the city to make it stop. At the time, Wilmington had 3 high schools, New Hanover, Hoggard, and Williston, Williston was the all-black school. And in 1969, the schools officially became desegregated, and Williston was temporarily closed, and it later became a junior high school. Students and teachers were sent to either Hoggard or to New Hanover. And that sounds like it should be a good thing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, both African American and Caucasian students and teachers resisted the change. The African American community cherished being a part of Williston and had taken great pride in their school and their sports. So now, students were excluded from sports at the new schools. So desegregation did not, by any standard, mean equal. It just meant intermixing a race at the school. They did not get the same rights at those schools. So people were suddenly fighting constantly, and police presence became commonplace at schools. And that quickly grew into rioting and then arson. So the school board building was actually set on fire. In January of 1971, African Americans were boycotting school. On February 1st, 1971, the United Church of Christ Commission on Racial Justice sent Reverend Benjamin Chavez to Wilmington to give speeches and try to provide structure to the students and the schools. Additionally, Pastor Eugene Templeton from Gregory Congregational United Church of Christ became involved. So as this spread like wildfire, the rights of white people, which is also known as ROWP, Try Not to Roll Your Eyes, who is a white supremacist group associated with the KKK, showed up with weapons and loud mouths. They were holding giant meetings in local parks where anyone could watch and join, and they created a lot of tension. So some African-American protesters went to City Hall to request a curfew. Because things were violent, they wanted a citywide curfew in place to prevent attacks and gunfire. And initially, that request was denied. So on February 6th, 1971, a convenience store named Mike's Grocery, which was located right near Gregory Congregational Church, was bombed. When police and firefighters responded to the scene, they were shot at from the church roof. They returned fire and killed 17-year-old Stephen Corbett, who was an African-American teenager who happened to have a gun. People in town began talking about guns protecting the church and bombs being made at the church. And the very next day, during a riot, Harvey Cumber, who was a white man with a gun, was killed inside of his truck outside of the church. The killer was never identified. After this incident, a curfew was put into place. In March, police had a list of 16 people who they suspected to have participated or conspired in the firebombing and shooting that occurred in February. 10 of them were arrested and convicted of, quote, I'm sorry, I'm an idiot.
Felonious.
Felonious.
Yes.
Felonious, is how you say it.
Yes.
Felonious. Are you positive? I'm trying to be all serious. Felonious burning and conspiracy to assault responding emergency personnel. So three African-American teenagers testified against them. These 10 people would become known as the Wilmington 10. 8 of them were African-American high school students who were male. Willie Vereen, Wayne Moore, Marvin Patrick, William, who went by Joe Wright, Reginald Epps, Connie Tyndall, James McCoy, and Jerry Jacobs. Benjamin Chavez and a white female social worker named Ann Shepherd Turner were the other two convicted. So that's the majority of the information that about the actual incident that doesn't come from somebody who was directly involved in the incident. That's like if you want to read up about it on Britannica, like that's kind of the basis of what you'll hear. But I thought it was really interesting to read about the different testimonies of people who were involved in this, because you learn something just completely different. So one of the people who testified, who's their main person here, was Alan Hall. He is 18 years old. Alan was currently serving time for arson, riot participation, and assault on emergency personnel from that very same day. He said he left the church with Patrick and Chavez, each with a gun. At the time, about 45 people were at the church. He stated that when police cars arrived, Patrick began to shoot. Chavez and himself joined in, and the police began shooting back. After 15 minutes, he says the three went back to the church. He was arrested for it in May of 1971. During his cross-examination, Allen revealed that he was tried in January of 1972. He states he spoke with two different detectives while incarcerated, Detective Brown and Detective Monroe. He gave them a written and signed statement. But not only that, he talked with them about 7 or 8 times. So he signed 2 written statements and told the same story to them each time. Well, according to him, after this shooting, they did what they called a Chicago strategy ambush, which I don't know what that means. I tried looking it up. I'm still unclear about what that means, but those are his words. So a Chicago strategy ambush on Mike's Grocery. According to Allen, Chavez instructed them to do this because it was owned by a white man. He told them to shoot at any patrol officers who arrived. He said him and Chavez passed out firebombs to Willie, Earl, Tyndall, Jacobs, McCoy, and Patrick. They went to a path that's behind Mike's Grocery. They saw no police, so they began throwing the firebombs at the store. There were a total of 8 firebombs. Allen threw the first one. After it was burning, Allen poured 2.5 gallons of gasoline in front of the door of the shop. Chavez instructed everyone to get into position. So the house next to the store caught on fire too. When personnel arrived, they began shooting at them. So, according to Allen, Patrick threw 2 of the firebombs, McCoy threw 2, and Tyndall threw 1. Allen himself threw 3. So these firebombs were gasoline-soaked rags and soda or wine bottles that were lit before being thrown. On Tuesday the 9th, they were planning on burning Merritt's Wholesome Bakery, Wilmington Bonded Warehouse, and France Neckwear, per Chavez's instruction. The people who were supposedly involved in this were Anne, Mike Peterson, Cornell Flowers, and James McCoy, and they made them at Anne's apartment. But she stayed behind as the other 4 left to burn the buildings around 9 p.m. Allen got stopped because lots of police were patrolling the area. He was alone when he stopped, and no buildings had gotten burned that night. He was not detained or arrested. During this part of the testimony, Chavez mouthed to him, quote, "I'll get you." Allen, who was caught looking at him, and a sheriff witnessed the interaction. Allen says that on February 7th, someone at the church was yelling that there was a truck coming up the street. Around 10 a.m., Chavez had a machine gun, Patrick had a machine gun, Tommy Atwood a rifle, and himself a pistol, so they went outside and shot at the truck. The man stopped and got out of the truck, and they continued to shoot at him until he fell. They went over towards him and discovered that he was dead. Allen identified the man from pictures as Harvey Cumber. He said their intention was to protect the church. On February 12, 1972, Allen wrote Shepard and Shepard a letter from prison that said in it, quote, "I got 12 years and you know I can't pull that much time, but Anne, Ben and them are going to tell the man that you had firebombs in your house and that we made them there. See, darling, you just can't let me down. If you do not help and things come down, you will be in it too, and you will go to jail just like I did. My wife has said that if you do not help, she is going to have someone to do you in. My wife and them will have you out of Wilmington. You are going to die. Can you dig? I will get you." In this letter, he had actually scratched out the word die. So it just says you are going to, and then it's scratched out. And in this letter, he also threatens to tell Anne's mother that she was having sexual relations with many of the members. Which is just a weird thing to say, even if it was true.
Yeah, I guess, but, like, what they were, like, trying to, like, do, it's just because it was pretty bad for you to be in an interracial relationship. So they probably try to, like, I guess, like, get her family to kind of, like, hate her because they didn't know, like, if her family was on... They assumed that her family was probably on their side versus being accepted if she really was going to be with somebody of color.
So that is very possible. But she's also saying... He's also, like, calling her a slut. He's trying to call her a slut.
Right. Right, right. So, like, back then, it was, like, dirty and, you know, it was... you know, taboo to do that. So that's probably where they were angling with that. And like you said, calling her right. slut on top of that. Anything they could to get, like, get her disowned potentially from her own family, which is disgusting that they... All this is just terrible. It really is.
And the whole thing... So that's the pretty much the conclusion of his testimony. If anybody's interested in reading it, it's like 60 pages. It's... Honestly, it's... That's the majority of it that's important. He ended up recanting it. He did the testimony in exchange for leniency on his own 12-year sentence. That is a very important... So he was the main witness testimony that they had in this case. The main person that they were able to use to prosecute these 10 people. And it was a straight-up lie.
Of course. Of course.
Parts of that could be true. He recanted it. So parts of it absolutely could be true. But there's no way to know what parts of that actually happened, which is why I didn't want to include it all in the beginning portion of this story, because those are the things that we know to be true. And this is just his statement that he eventually recanted. So I'm sure parts of that, like the firebombing, aligns with the things that happened. But, you know, there's so many questions surrounding that. And they did have a lot of other witness testimonies too. For example, they had Fred Smith. He lived in a second-story apartment and heard a noise, which was a firebomb hitting Mike's grocery. He had gone out onto his porch, and he saw people with guns in the street. One spotted him and called out, "There is one, let him have it." So he ducked into his apartment, and 9 bullets entered his place. But he was okay. There was Rebecca Watts. She was coming home from the movies with her husband, and they got shot at in their car. She got away and she was taken to the hospital with something in her eye and a wounded finger. The car was damaged and glass was broken because 5 gunshots impaled the side of the car. There's Reverend James Jones, who was leaving the church with his neighbor, T.D. Love, who was outside hiding behind a tree with a pistol. And just to clarify, he was leaving a different church, not the church where all these people were in. So, on the other side of the street, men had large guns, and someone called out to him, "Father Jones, is that you?" And he told them yes, and that his neighbor was with him. So they told him to, you know, get out from behind the tree, and the two of them walked home. He had no idea who the person was who called out to him. T.D. Love, the person who ended up walking home with Reverend Jones, heard gunfire. So he went outside with his pistol, and he saw 4 men running back and forth. And he heard one of them call out to Father James. There was W.H. Butler Jr., who went to the church on February 6th at 1:30 p.m. There were people all over, mostly outside, and he saw one with a large rifle. They were all loitering and drinking. Inside of the church, he observed damage to the pews and carpet. There was a knife on a table in the church and empty alcohol bottles laying around. He saw Chavez in street clothes and told him that it was wrong and those people shouldn't be there, to which, according to him, Chavez said, quote, "Man, you don't know what you're talking about." Later that night, he saw Mike's grocery during the fire. And then there's Mike Poulos, who is the owner of Mike's grocery. He testified that the building was 2 stories, his shop on the bottom floor, and the second floor was actually apartments. He had owned it for 12 years. He also owned a house next to it for 5 years. At the time of the incident, Lillian McKeithen was living there. She had been living there for 5 years. So when he went to check out the aftermath, he saw a broken window with gasoline in the windowsill, and there were drink bottles inside and a bunch of firebombs. In the apartment above, Richard Keene, the resident, was out of town that weekend. Thank goodness. He knew it had happened because it was on the news, so he tried to go to it immediately, but everything was blocked off. He had three cars that he kept at the store and at a garage behind it, all of which he lost to the fire. Both his store and his house next door were completely demolished. Then there was Lillian McKeithen. So she was the one who lived in that house next door. And she had been hearing gunfire for a couple of nights. So she decided she didn't want to stay at the house that night. And she thankfully was not there. She lost all of her belongings, but she was able to keep her life, more importantly. And then there's Mrs. Jackson, who is the neighbor on Lillian's other side, so two doors down from the grocery store. She had been living there for 4 years with her husband, her daughter, and her four grandkids.
Oh no.
They were all home when the fire started. She called 911 and grabbed her family and left the house. She heard lots of shooting. Her home caught on fire. She put the grandkids with a friend across and down the street and hid behind trees with her husband to watch the fire destroy their home. Can you imagine that?
No, definitely not. And then with, like, her daughter and then her four grandchildren, that's crazy. That's, your whole life is just literally bursting into flames.
I know. And I know that happened to a lot of people here. It's devastating. But to actually physically watch it. Again, I'm just very glad they were able to get out.
Like, when I was younger, our car had caught on fire. And we were actually, like, moving from a different state. And this is when I was probably, like, 7 years old or something.
Okay.
Like, I just remember it. And we were parked on the side of the highway. And, like, the car just caught on fire. And it was so, like, devastating. So I couldn't even imagine watching my home where, you know, obviously our car, like, it had all of our stuff, but, like, literally your home that you've been in for years, like, that's you, that's your family, that's everything you have in there. Like, you couldn't have, like, they couldn't save anything. They right. just, they had to get out of there. Thank God they did, but
I know.
It's just crazy.
And everybody always circles back to, you know, and I do agree that, you know, of course it's much more important. You can replace material possessions, but you can't, you know, replace lives. And while that's true, there are so many memories and so many things, you know, so many significant things that people have in their home that just to lose it all like that would be heartbreaking.
Absolutely. Really, like, I would sit here and I think about the stuff that I have of Ollie's when she first came home from the hospital and stuff mm-hmm. that's not easily accessible in my house. Like, it's in the attic or right. something. Like, and if some ever happened, God forbid, like, if we would have to leave in a hurry, like, something like that, I would lose all of that. And it would just be devastating. But, like you said, at least my family would be intact and, you know, we'd all be safer. But still, exactly. It's heartbreaking.
I'm gonna go off on a tangent actually for a second. If nobody wants to listen to it, just skip forward like 2 minutes. So during Hurricane Florence that hit here, what year was that? 2018. It was in like September.
It was because Ollie was born right after.
So what great timing. So September of 2018, we got hit by a bad hurricane. It actually, the eye of the hurricane actually hit where we live. So my family evacuated, and I remember, because we're like, okay, I was going with my parents and my aunt, and then my brother met us there. But so we had fit four people and a dog in one car, and we had to get all of our stuff, you know, whatever we could fit into the car. Yeah. And so we each were allotted one bag, right? And it's so weird, because we had, like, 3 days. We knew we had, like, 3 days. We're like, okay, we have time to sit here and think about this. And it's crazy when you have that time to sit there and be like, okay, what things do I really not want to lose? And it's sad because, like, I find myself like, okay, well, I can't lose all my paperwork. Mm-hmm. Like, I got to get my birth certificate and my passport. And you know what I mean? It's, like, things that, like, I wish I didn't, like, need yeah. to have. But, you like, I mean, it would suck to lose. And then, you know, you think about, okay, well, what about all these pictures? Like, I have all these pictures of my grandparents and stuff like that I don't have right. electronically, because that wasn't a thing, you know what I mean, when they were alive. And I'm like, oh, God. And then there's all this. And then there's, you know what I mean? I know people, you know, now my parents have my dog's ashes right. on the mantle. You know what I mean? Like, we would bring that with now. And it's just, it's so hard to try to, you know, try to find things. First of all, you still need clothes. You still need, you know what I mean? You still need things to, like, yes, yes, you still need toothpaste, but you also have to try to fit. I challenge anybody, if you're up for that sometime, mm-hmm. just to, like, really, just if you really want to depress yourself, try to fit all of your stuff in a carry-on suitcase that you would need for a week, knowing that you may never come back to your house. It is the weirdest, weirdest feeling, and just watching it all burn away just sounds so devastating. I cannot imagine, because that's hard even when you have time to grab the things that you need.
Right, exactly. I also, when I lived in Texas, we had a flood. Like, it was a really bad flood. Like, I'm 5'3". That's not very tall. And we had to walk from the inside, from our house to, like, the next door neighbor. And literally the water was up to my waist. It was the scariest thing ever. And we had no time to grab anything. Like, and when we finally were able to come back, everything was ruined. And it's like I said, it's devastated. It was my grandparents' house, and you know, they had, like, my cousins, like, Sweet 15 dress, like, all these memories of my cousins when they were young, and pictures of my aunts and uncles when they were younger, like, things that were passed down, generational things, like, mm-hmm. it's crazy. It sucks.
It does suck. Whew. This took a turn. Sorry. This took it a really did, dark sorry. Turn. Well, no, this whole thing, I mean, even think about it, even just Mike, that was his business, that was his life, and that was his income. You know, he had the two places that he rented out, he had Elle's car, right. This is the place that he ran business, and that, you know, that's really hard. And, you know, the people who put so much time and effort into that church that people destroyed, that's hard too. You know what I mean? And it just sucks, because it could have all been prevented. Like, there's no reason for things like this to have to take place. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have, I mean, they shouldn't have killed people, but, you know, I'm not saying that people shouldn't be upset, and that people shouldn't react, and that people shouldn't do things. And it just sucks that, that these exactly. things still happen, that these things are still crazy. Happening. It is.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the last witness testimony I just wanted to mention was Sergeant Bloomer. He was one of the people who had pulled up originally with Sergeant Jeans, and Med came from the churchyard with guns, and they began shooting at them. One of them actually hit Sergeant Jeans, and he was taken to the hospital, and the car was punctured with many bullets. They also saw the guys with guns shooting out the streetlights. And he is one of many officers and firemen at the scene who testify that firemen had to leave the scene because there were bullets flying everywhere. So the emergency personnel was not safe, and they were not able to put out the fire. It's not that they weren't there. That is crazy to think about.
It really is. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm, like, speechless.
I know.
All of this is kind of crazy. It's just a lot. Like, I really, like, couldn't imagine being around during this time. And to think this was all in, you said, in 1969?
It started, this whole thing right now is in 1971.
Okay, 71. That's even worse. My dad was born in 72. He's 50 years old. Like, this happened 50 years ago.
Right. It's like, not that long ago.
Crazy. Like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. I, like, you know, and sorry, this might be another tangent, like, just really quick, I'm sure we could talk about this later after we're done with the, you know, the rest of the info for this episode, but, like, it's shocking, but it's not, because just in the little, I've been here for 10, 11 years now. And the things that I've come to find out about Wilmington in general is that it's really, like, it's come from really racist roots.
Yeah.
And it's shocking, but it's not. And it's sad that it's not. I don't know.
It is. It's really sad. And I just wish that we could progress further to a point where we can say, I mean, it's never going to make the past okay, but at least we can say we have very obviously moved forward from that, and we're not at that place right now. And that sucks. So I want the trial took place on September 11th of 1972. So this is about a year and a half after the incident happened. And I want to tell you again the names of the 10 people and what they were like, quote unquote, listed as. So during this whole thing, they talk to each person about, what their living situation is and if they own any property and things like that. But other than that, there's
Okay.
not a lot of information. So I just want to give you kind of like an idea a little bit of, what these guys' situations, what these people's situations were. So William, who went by Joe Wright, he was living with his parents. He had three siblings and he was 19 years old. Again, this age is a year and a half after the actual incident. So he's either 18 or 19 at the time that it happened, or so, I guess it could be 17, depending on
Like
exactly when
17
it
and a
happened.
half.
Huh?
He could be like 17 and a
Yeah, he
half.
could be like any sort of age. Okay. But so, I don't have their exact date of birth, so just keep in mind this is about a year and a half after it happened. So he's 19. He had four felonies. So he had a really hard time getting a job, didn't have a job, and he had no property, didn't own a car, nothing like that. There's Marvin Patrick, who was 20 years old, who owned no property, had no car. There was Reginald Epps, who was 19 years old, and he was married. He had eight siblings. His mother and stepfather, who he lives with, support him. He finished high school in jail. He owns no property or a car. There's Wayne Moore, who was 19 years old. He also finished high school in jail, and that's because they were arrested for this. I don't mean like,
Okay.
so keep that in mind because they're 19 years old. Like, they finished high school in jail because they got arrested while they were in high school during this period of time. That's what
Gotcha.
I mean by that. Like,
Okay.
they continued and they finished high school, but they had already been arrested, pre-trial. You don't just get to hang out, unfortunately. I guess it's for the better in most
Right.
cases, but he lived with his mother. He owned no property or car. He did have a job prior to his initial arrest, but after his manager found out what happened, he asked him to leave. So there's Willie Earl Vereen, who was 18 years old. He was still in school. He was only a sophomore, and he owned no property or car. There was Jerry Jacobs, who was 20 years old. He had been working prior to the arrest at a filling station. He lived with his mom and his parents were separated. He had a child on the way and was planning on getting married. He also owned no property or a car. There's James McCoy, who was 19 years old. He worked at a lumber company prior to his arrest. He also had no property or a car. There was Connie Tindall, who was 22 years old, who was a longshoreman before his arrest. He also owned no property or a car. So, just want to remind you that in addition to Alan Hall recanting his statement, which remember is the main statement that put those were eight people that I just told you, but there's also Benjamin Chavez and Ann Shepard. Though that those statements, those testimonies are what put these people in jail and what got them convicted. He recanted his statement and three other witnesses recanted. I could not find which ones. But so a total of four people, including their main testifier, recanted their statements. But the prosecution pushed, and the jurors consisted of six black people, six white people. They said they would make it even. It was a mixture of men and women. So Willie Earl Vereen, James McCoy, Reginald Epps, Wayne Moore, Joe Wright, Benjamin Chavez, Marvin Patrick, Jerry Jacobs, and Connie Tindall all were charged guilty and with conspiracy to assault emergency personnel with a dangerous weapon and burning Mike's grocery store building with an incendiary device. Ann Shepard was charged as guilty of accessory before the fact of the burning of Mike's grocery store with an incendiary device. So Vereen got 20 to 24 years, Jacobs 20 to 24 years, Moore 20 to 24 years, McCoy 20 to 24 years, Tindall 22 to 26 years, Wright 20 to 24 years, Epps 20 to 24 years, Patrick 22 to 26 years, Chavez 25 to 29 years, and Shepard 7 to 10 years. So I can't even. Okay, So Amnesty International, who aims to release political prisoners and publicize government violations of human rights, got involved, and it led to protests which continued even through 1978, when thousands of people marched in Washington, D.C. for the release of the Wilmington 10. After this, their sentence was commuted by North Carolina Governor James Hunt. And do you know what that means? I did not know what that means. So I'm just going to ask you straight up.
No. Okay.
So for everybody who does not know what that means, it means that the conviction is upheld, but your sentence is reduced. Which is bullshit. So they're basically saying, oh, okay, so in 1979, they were released from prison. So they got arrested in 71. They spent 8 years in prison. So now they're like, okay, well, now you can leave now, but we're still saying you're all guilty of these crimes.
It's ridiculous. And even then, like, even with them, with how many, four witnesses recanting what they said, like, and they're still considering them guilty, but then they let them out from 20 to 24 year sentence, max sentences for some of them, but you're letting them out after 8 years, but you're still saying they're guilty.
That's correct. That's exactly right.
That doesn't make any fucking sense.
It doesn't make sense. And it just is really stupid, too, because I'm not saying that they weren't involved. They very well probably were involved, because a lot of people who, you know, were involved in these riots, whatever, were also a part of this whole giant thing here. But them specifically were all named by these specific witnesses who recanted their testimonies. You cannot prosecute somebody on recanted testimonies. What other evidence do you have? And the answer for them was none. None. Only these testimonies. So a direct quote from Britannica on the matter states, in 1980, the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals voided the convictions on the basis of prosecutorial, damn it.
Good job.
Prosecutorial misconduct, but it's hard.
I know.
Okay, on the basis of prosecutorial misconduct by Assistant District Attorney Jay Stroud, who had coached and bribed the witnesses and altered the written statement of the primary witness, Alan Hall. Three key witnesses also recanted. On December 31st, 2012, North Carolina Governor Beverly Perdue officially pardoned the Wilmington 10, saying that their sentences were, quote, tainted by naked racism. It took until 2012 for them to officially be pardoned.
I see, this is where I kind of get stuck out with things like this. Like, yeah, you know, it's wonderful that they were pardoned, but those 8 years, they'll never get those 8 years back.
Yeah, and then they spent the next, they spent the next, you know, 30 some odd years being technically guilty. I mean,
exactly. Like, they're never gonna get all this time where they've been, you know, portrayed as these people who did these awful things. Like, they're never gonna get that back. And it's, and you know, some of them, like you said, like, they weren't able to get jobs, like, obviously with felonies on their record, like, that's hard. And this has altered their life in a negative light, and it's like, thank you, but at the same time, like, it's a little too late.
Yeah. It needed to happen, but it needed to happen sooner, and it needed to be more than just a pardoning.
Right.
But, as we have it, that is the case of the Wilmington 10. And it's pretty shocking.
Yeah. It's definitely shocking. It's shocking, but then it's not. Like I said earlier, just with Wilmington's history and everything, it's, I don't know. Like, I'm glad they were pardoned. I'm glad that their names are cleared. Did you happen to say why, do we know why these people were targeted specifically?
I do not know. My thought is that they were, I mean, a lot of people were involved in these riots and these protests. But that does not mean that they were involved in, you know, what they were officially being charged of, which is conspiracy and of arson. And I don't know. I don't know if it's because they were names that they could prove were there, or if it's because that's just who their witnesses named. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking the whole time. Kind of like, why specifically these 10 people?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's terrible. And that's the conclusion of our local season.
Yeah, I'm happy it's over. I don't know about you, but I've come to learn how, like, just not great this area is. Like, you know, like, it's not amazing.
It's true everywhere. Everywhere has its issues.
Right, exactly.
But yeah.
Yeah, no. You know what I was thinking about whenever we were talking about this? I was thinking about, like, what was it? Is it, like, the Azalea Festival? One of the festivals.
Uh-huh.
It's, like, I remember hearing about it, and this could be a rumor. Okay, anybody can, like, stop listening now. Like, this episode. Like, I'm about to get in some other shit.
The episode is over. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
Now we're going to ramble and bitch. So, you know where to find us if you want to see pictures. And if you want to hang out, hang out.
Yes. Instagram, Crafts, Drafts, and Crime. Twitter, Crafts and Crime. Gmail, Crafts, Drafts, and Crime @gmail.com. Send the stories. And Facebook, Crafts, Drafts, and Crime. Okay. So really quick. I can't remember if it's the Azalea Festival or what's the other festival we have? River Festival? Is that River? Riverwalk? I don't fucking know. The other one. Either way, one of those festivals that we have, I remember hearing, you know, when I first moved here, that one of those was actually, like, their origin was actually, what is that? I think that's Front Street. Mm-hmm. Is those big, giant, beautiful trees. What are they? Like oak trees? I don't fucking know what kind of trees are. They're just really pretty. That basically it was a festival where they would hang black people down that entire street, Front Street. And it would be like parades.
You're fucking joking. Going down.
I swear to God, I heard it. I don't know where. Like I said, it could definitely be like, you know, just, you know, how shit gets passed down. That's why I said, like, I remember hearing it. I remember, like, people telling me about it, because there's, like, a good majority of people who do not support those festivals for that reason specifically to this day.
Do you think it's something I can Google? Is that, like, a Google searchable thing?
Possibly. Let's see. I had already stored it. Let's see. No.
I don't even know what to think about that. That's insane. I know that the Azalea Festival, people dress up in these, I want to say costumes, but they're not costumes. They're like
the big fancy dresses.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like giant dresses that have like the, what are the big poofy skirts that you put underneath your dress called?
I don't know.
Oh, man. It's going to bother me. I bought one drunk when I was like 19. I just really needed one, and I never once wore it. But you put it to make your skirt, like, flare out and whatever, and then they go and they do the weird thing, you know, the curly things with their hair, like, they're back in the day, and then you can go into the, like, really old historic houses and stuff like that. So my inkling is that it's probably the Azalea skirts. Festival. It's not hoop.
Antebellum hoop skirts, no.
Is it an antebellum-related thing? Because this all starting to make sense.
I think so. It says, when I looked it up, it said, it's a family-oriented festival with a true Southern flair to it. And that is what our city is all about. Awful lot of Southern charm. Graceful bells in antebellum hoop skirts escorted by gray-jacketed military cadets.
Okay. That's okay.
Yeah. I swear to God, like, I have no idea where I heard that from. Like, I feel bad for saying it and not having any, like, having any facts to back it up. But, like, I swear to you, somebody, like, I've heard that more than once.
That's really bothersome. And I will definitely have to try to research that more, because that's definitely not something, I mean, I don't go anyways because I hate crowds like that. But that's something I would definitely discourage people from going to if that were the case. So we need to find the answer to that. And we will let you all know when we do find out. And if you didn't listen to this part of the podcast, you'll just be really confused, but that's fine. Okay. Shit.
Oh, I'm starting to get into the stuff. Okay. So this is from Star News Online. I'm going to cite my source. Okay, so I'm going to read it verbatim. Maybe I'll switch a couple words. So basically, for some members of the community, however, Antebellum flavor carries a bitter aftertaste. There was a little good about the good old South in the eyes of people whose ancestors were enslaved, forced to labor in rags so that those privileged by white skin could cavort in delicate ball gowns. That's what they're called, ball gowns.
It's not the word, though. It's a thing that you put underneath a skirt. I'm going to look it up. You keep telling me the things.
We'll have to do it. Okay. Opinion on just how offensive the Bell's hoop skirts are varies among Wilmingtonians. That's so funny that they call them that. Of African ancestry. City Council member Lethea Hankins, a respected Black educator whose pioneering work toward racial dialogue after Wilmington schools were desegregated, still wins praise, finds the dresses personally distasteful and makes no secret of her dislike. So let's see.
Also, it's a petticoat, the thing I'm talking about.
Petticoat. Okay, that makes sense.
I owned one for like 5 years, and turns out that's not really a thing that you wear.
But you see, like, it does have some, like, obvious, like, you know, racist roots in it.
It's so crazy that, you know, that things like that exist, and it's so easy to not know anything about it. You know, the people are just like, oh, hey, are you going to the festival this weekend? And I'm like, oh, I don't know what food trucks are going to be there. You know what I mean? Like, right, you don't even think about the like, fact. I'm sorry if that's really ignorant, but I, you know, just, you know, you don't think about, oh, yeah, there's a festival in town. It's called the Azalea Festival. We're known for azaleas in North Carolina. Like, I'm not, no part of me in any way is thinking that this is possibly tied to something other than let's go make some money for the community, you know, for local business and for whatever, which Wilmington's really big on. And that's really shocking and disturbing.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, so, yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know. Like, honestly, like, when we first got here, like, we would go and, you know, it was a festival. Fuck it. It was awesome. And then I started hearing shit like this, and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, right. Why am I going somewhere that supported this? Which is why, if you've ever gone to the Copper Penny?
Don't ruin the Copper Penny for me. I love the Copper Penny.
Maybe it wasn't the Copper Penny. It was the Cottage Exchange.
Oh, okay. That's very different. Love
the Cottage Exchange. Yes, it is very different. Sorry, Copper Penny. No shade. I don't know why I thought about that. But
because you want a cheesesteak?
Maybe. The Cotton Exchange. That right there. Have you heard the story of, like, the history in that?
No, but please tell me.
Bro, this is what I'm telling you. Like, that whole bullshit, like, haunted ghost walk tour we did was bullshit. I'm not even from Wilmington, and I know more about Wilmington than that fucking person did. I would have taken us to all the good fucking spots. Anyways, so the Cotton Exchange is uber haunted, just FYI, for anybody who cares like I do. But it's haunted because the Cotton Exchange used to be where they used to sell slaves at the Cotton Exchange.
Are you serious?
Yes.
How did it turn into this thing with coffee shops and restaurants and beads?
Hipsters, like, it's hip now. Like, oh man, let me just pull this up for you real quick. Yes, I remember. Once again, I remember hearing about this.
Oh my god, is that what it used to be called too?
I don't think it was. I'm gonna look it up Yeah, the antebellum venue for cotton trade and by happenstance slave trade is still actively used as a center for commerce, whose signage presents the celebratory slogan of historically good shopping and dining. So, Wilmington in particular was home to quite a few plantations, like Poplar Grove Plantation, with evocation of
we are not word people for the millionth time.
I just totally stopped that.
I've never even thought about Poplar Grove. They have some like walking trails and stuff over there.
Yeah, like, I'm be honest, anywhere that says like plantation, anything like that, I'm not doing it. I'm be honest with you, I don't think I want to go
there. It's just, it's so weird though, because it's just like a little farming thing, and they have like just hiking trails and stuff that like, I just, why? I don't know. I just thought it was like a name. You know what I mean? I don't know. It never occurred to me, which I guess things shouldn't be called that anyways. I feel ignorant as shit.
It's okay, but I, and this is something that I've come to realize within myself these last few years. It's just that, like, things like that, I feel like plantations now have become so, like, romanticized in a way. Like, I don't know if that's the right word, but, like, I feel like it, just ignoring what they represented to thousands and thousands, millions of people years back, like, it's just, it's all ignored now, and it's all like, oh my god, this house is huge, this land is beautiful, but like, let's remember those fucking little barns and shit that over those little buildings in the yard, like, those are where people actually live, like multiple families in one of those, like, it's fucking crazy to me. I don't know, maybe I'm just, I get triggered a little bit about it. I don't know, but it's just, I don't know. Like, I always said I wanted to go visit fucking, what's the thing? What's the mansion? The Bellamy Mansion. Uh-huh. But then sometimes I'm like, why do I want to visit it? Because it was in the middle of a fucking plantation. Like, it was on a, like, all of downtown Wilmington was, like, pretty much its front and backyard. And, you know, they had slaves on there. I don't know. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, now you can pay to go inside of it. It's a really weird concept.
Right, exactly. But yeah, that's Wilmington.
All right, I think this has been enough of a depressing night. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I think we're good. I think we're good now.
Thanks for anybody who decided to keep listening. Guys. That was interesting.
Here, history of Wilmington, North Carolina with Jasmine and Valerie.
Yeah,
mainly Jasmine. And surprising Valerie with different things that Jasmine's heard of.
Here is the episode to make you hate where we live. Okay, thanks. Goodbye.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry. And, you know, there may be some people that don't agree with me, and that's fine. You know, I'm up for the discussion.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening through and through. We are excited to bring you episode 9 coming, or nope, season 9. Oh, episode 9. Don't make me go back that far. That's so much work. We've put in so much work into this. Thank you guys so much for listening. And we're starting to use new audio capturing tools, so we hope that it is a little bit easier on your ears. If not, look, I'm an amateur and I'm broke. So...
Right, I was literally, I'm glad you brought it up, because I was going to bring it up anyways. Me and Valerie were literally talking about that today, and, like, I was like, I just got an alert from my bank. I got 50 cents in my bank account. What can we do with that? I was like, big ballers.
We do get comments about our audio frequently, and we know that we're not professional, and we know that people are bringing it toward, and you know, our attention, in case, like, we're not aware, like, we don't think that anybody's being mean, but
right,
we, you know, we both work full-time jobs, and we, you know, and on top of researching this, you know, I do a lot of that part, and Jasmine has a child, a small child. We both have, you know, relationships that we're in, families that we see, and it's, right. you know, this is just a, not to call it like a side gig, because that makes it sound like it's a thing. This is a hobby for us. This is something that we want right. to do just because we enjoy doing it. And we like that people listen and we think it's great. And it's something we would love to be able to, like, do a ton of. I would love this to be my full-time job, and I would pay for all the equipment and all the things, but as of right now, you know, this is not a monetized, you know, thing for us, so we're trying the best we can with the free resources that we can use, because, you know, we're trying to keep things, you know, just is, you know, as good as we can, because in addition to, you know, all the work that we normally do and that we put into this, spending money on it too is not really a practical choice. And unfortunately, we don't have that ability to record in the same area. We live over 30 minutes apart. And again, with our situations, exactly. I mean, I would never see anybody.
Right. I would have to bring the kid, and then, like, the kid wouldn't be able to see her dad, and then I wouldn't be able to see her dad, and then you wouldn't see your boyfriend, and then it'd just be a whole thing, and then me and Valerie would be living alone with, you know, a kid, and yeah, it would just not be a great time for us.
That was a little dramatic. But it would significantly decrease the joy that we have in doing this. Because we already put right, so much time right. and effort into it that if we were to, okay, now I gotta spend an hour in the car and now we're working in a different scenario. Like, it just, it changes everything. Like, sometimes we're like, okay, we do this right. at night a lot because, like, okay, her daughter has gone to bed. Okay, my boyfriend has gone to bed because they have the same bedtime.
They do.
And we're like, okay, this is perfect. And, you know, and we can start doing things now. You know, it's not really like, okay, well, it's 8:30. Let me pack up and, you know, drive so that I can do this for, you know, it takes a while because we have to stop and we have to, yeah. then we do edits and then we. So, yeah, anyways, I'm just rambling, but, you know.
And no, it's okay. Like, I feel like maybe people will, like, really understand us now and why we get into rants and why we're, like, so, like, you know, why we try to bring some comedy into it. Because it's, like, this is, like you said, this is a hobby at the end of the day. This right. is something we like to do. And when it starts to feel like a job, it's like you've lost the joy in it. And it's, you know, I don't think either one of us want that to happen.
No,
so
I don't.
We're going to keep trying to do what we can do to, you know, make it better, but, you know, we, like you said, we're working with what we got.
Yeah. And we keep trying new things.
We definitely appreciate all the feedback. You know, we ask it every single episode, and the fact that you guys feel, you know, comfortable enough to tell us, like, we're grateful for that at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we want to be able to do those things to make it. I want to be the best sounding voice you've ever heard. First of all, that's not possible.
I know my voice is, like, amazing, so yes.
Neither one of us have particularly nice voices.
Altered.
We both have very basic, like, stupid voices.
We do.
But, like if the quality was better, you know, it would, you know, and it's just, it's one of those sacrifices we've had to make to be able to get episodes out the way that we do. You know, I know a lot of people who do this as a hobby do it, you know, a lot less frequently, but, you know, we did 70 episodes in a year, and we're very proud of that, and we want to maintain,
yes.
you know, that awesome... the awesome thing that we're doing. So just bear with exactly. us. I promise you, we're trying to get there. That's the thing I want to just, you know, emphasize over and over again, is we are trying to get there, and we hope that we get there because we want to. And I'm not saying I need this to be my full-time job, though I would love it, and if that's ever an opportunity, I will do it. But if it got to a point where, you know, we were making a little bit of money off of it, we would be putting that money directly back into it. So, like, if you're a Patreon subscriber, that money will turn into going into, you know, different recording things and making our quality exactly. better. So that just, it's a whole cycle, and it'll be great. And then we can get better quality mics, and I could get a computer that actually does this stuff better, but that's beside the point.
Me too.
I know. I have a Chromebook, and though it's fine, the purpose that I got it is just because I needed to be able to use Word, Excel, and the internet. But doing podcasting, I'm like, oh shit, this doesn't, like, accept any equipment or any programming. But so, you know, just know that we are trying, and we're making those efforts. And we hope that by episode 100, which I know is a while from now, it's going to be probably about the beginning of the year, we are hoping that we are at that spot where we're like, ah, oh, okay, we sound how we want to sound. And that's a long time into a podcast. We get it. But again, we're the little guy.
Absolutely.
We're nobody.
Yeah, we're not there yet. We're getting there slowly but surely. And you guys, all of you out there, all of the 5 million that listen to us will get us there. I know you can. I have faith in you. 5 million. Can you imagine?
5 million.
Okay, now you guys are with us manifesting. So you're welcome for this episode.
Why are you still listening? You guys are awesome. If you're still listening, wow, you just like listening to us talk.
I was going to say, you're weird. This is just turning
into a ramble.
Get away. No, just kidding.
This has gone a different direction. I don't even know what we're talking about anymore. We can just have a podcast with Jazz and Val at, you know, maybe that should be one of our Patreon things. You just want to listen to us talk? Because we do that.
Yeah.
Nobody would pay for that content.
I don't know. I'm pretty hilarious. So.
I don't know. But anyways, thank you for listening.
Yes. I appreciate you guys goes. You guys. And we love you. And yeah.
We do. I feel like we're like that person who's like, okay, no, you hang up. No, you hang up. Because really, we keep like, just like keep going. Like one of us has to end it, but neither one of us is taking the bait. So I will end it.
Okay, bye.
We'll just keep talking. I don't know. It's just, see, that's the thing too, is we get goofy sometimes because it's late and I'm tired.
Right.
But, you know, but thank you guys for listening, and thank you for listening all the way to the end. You guys are crazy. I bet it's our closest friends who are just like, you guys are ridiculous. But we love you.
We're never singing.
All right, guys. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye.